welcome to Wednesday's edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are glad that you are joining us today. Thanks for listening. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in the second half of today's show, another of our great Prairie Plates series, Rick Gion serves up a delicious conversation with chef and author Sarah Watson, whose sold-out cookbook, Cabin Chef, stirs up stories of family, food, and life at the lake, plus a bonus bite, Rick's interview with Molly Yeh from her recent Fargo book event. And we begin Main Street today as we take a ride through North Dakota's railroading pass at the State Railroad Museum in Mandan. With full-size rail cars, handmade models, and rare photos, the museum brings history to life across 5 acres of tracks and stories. And joining us is longtime museum leader Bill Engelter. We're going to talk about trains, community, and why this slice of history still resonates today. Bill, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you for asking me to be there.
You betcha. We're glad that you are with us today. What are some of the most historically significant artifacts that you have in the North Dakota State Railroad Museum?
Wow, that's a tough question. You know, we've been involved with the Railroad Museum for 40 years. We acquired the 1890 steel depot, which was transported to Mandan and put on site, and we remodeled it and updated it to look like it did in 1890. We also have several pieces of rolling stock that kind of date back. There's one boxcar that we have that is called a fish belly, and it has a metal frame on the bottom that kind of resembles the bottom of a fish and so forth. It's a little different. It's a 1904 model.
What stories are you trying to really tell about North Dakota's railroad history?
Well, I think how important the railroads was to North Dakota. And one of my projects was to acquire pictures of all the depots from around the state of North Dakota and so forth. And we have a collection of those in our depot and so forth with a big map from 1916 that tells the story of where the tracks ran and all the little stations and stops that it would make. It was so important for the railroad to be involved because they brought people and stuff into the state and took agriculture products out of the state. And that's how they kind of maintain and develop the railroad business in North Dakota.
Surely different today. Obviously, many of those photos that you have and map delineations of where depots are, they don't even exist anymore.
Yeah, that's correct. In 1904, I think it was about, on the northern part of the state, there was a war between two different railroad companies, the Soo Line and the Great Northern, trying to acquire different areas to bring their goods and so forth. And so they helped develop that area and so forth. It was important to the settlers that they could get there because there was no roads, no cars, no, and the railroad was the only way that they could acquire the land grants and so forth in North Dakota.
How do you approach, Bill, the preservation then and even restoration of not only rolling stock but some other artifacts that you have? Is it tough working with just yourself or just a very small staff?
You know, with regard to our rolling stock and our artifacts, most of them have been given to us or acquired by us, and they basically we try to at least maintain a reasonable appearance of them. You know, we don't try to restore anything specifically. We're not in the restoration thing. We're in people that enjoy our museum from all over the nation that stop here, enjoy the rolling stock that we have, a lot of the artifacts that we have inside our buildings and that tell some of the history and relate to. I think one of the important things that our museum offers to our community and to visitors is that everybody loves trains. Well, you come to the Railroad Museum at Mandan, North Dakota, you want to go inside of a caboose, We have a caboose, a couple cabooses that you can go inside and actually see what the inside of a caboose looks like. We also have a refrigerator car that we acquired that shows the thick walls and how the ice was dropped in the one end and so forth. Plus, we have probably one of the best original hand tools that the railroad people used to use to maintain the railroad. We have a lot of photos that show different railroad things that are happening and so forth. So that helps tell a little bit more about the history and so forth.
What are the hours of the museum and how can people come and see? And is there a fee to come to the museum, Bill?
Well, we're open June, July, and August every day from 1 to 4. And we have some special days that we have Father's Day on June 15th, of course. We have a Watermelon Days in July that we kind of just acquired and adopted. And then we have Railroad Days in August 24th. These are special days where we invite the families to come out and enjoy the atmosphere and see things that are happening. The kids love our model trains that run. And then we have a mini train that we run and give the youngsters rides on and so forth. And we do that just on those special days. But when parents come with their children, you know, or the grandparents come with their grandkids and so forth, it's a great photo op for them to take pictures of their kids standing on the end of caboose, walking the rails.
Is there a fee to come to the museum?
We have never adopted a fee. Years ago, I was down in St. Paul and so forth, and at one of the environments there, they had a sign that said, admission is free, suggested donations, so much for adults or kids and so forth. And so we adopted that approach. We don't want to deny anyone, you know, in today's world with the cost of when you go to museums and other locations where you have to pay, it might cost a family $40 or $50 just to attend. We don't charge that at all. We rely on the public.
We're enjoying our conversation with Bill Engelter. He's the president of the North Dakota State Railroad Museum, a job he's had for about 26 of the 40 years that it has been open here in North Dakota. What are the biggest challenges that you have in preserving a museum like this and making it available to the public?
I guess trying to find volunteers at times. It's a continuous process of, you know, when people come in and if there's somebody that might be interested and participating and so forth and getting them involved. We used to have a board membership of 15, which worked really well. And in the last few years, a lot of our volunteers have retired or disappeared. So we're always looking for some younger, interested people.
Does the museum have any future plans? Is there any expansion that you've thought about? Anything that you would like to acquire, perhaps?
Well, I recall back when we started, the goal was that we acquire a depot. We attempted to get the depot in Mandan as our museum, and that failed because the railroad was going to use it for other commercial purposes and so forth. So we've acquired now. We attempted to acquire a steam engine at one time, and that failed. We did find and acquire a diesel engine, which was one of the original switch engines back in the 1939s and the 40s. There's one item that we talked about years and years ago was we were looking at a coach car. And because of the condition and stuff of the one that we looked at, you know, the board members weren't totally in agreement to acquire it. So that's one thing that's kind of on our to-go list is it would be really nice if we could find a coach car because a coach car would add something additional to the railroad scene at our railroad museum. We have a lot of boxcars. a tank car. We have a little mini goat or mule, which we acquired from Montana. You know, at one time they just called, hey, do you want it? We said, yes, we'll take it. So when the railroad was retiring stuff, the atmosphere of the railroads is more big business. And I think when we started, we had such good cooperation from the local railroad companies and the personnel helping us to develop our museum.
Tell me more about the model railroads that you have inside the depot there, and who created them and how are they maintained?
Well, we, you know, that's an important area too. The having someone that is into model railroading is important because they know how to maintain the track and maintain the equipment and so forth to make it run. This last year, we had somebody that had started years ago and was involved with the Railroad Museum and then kind of took a little vacation and so forth. I came back, and he, Terry Lance, is an excellent modeler, very detailed with regard to everything that is done, and knows all the ins and outs of how to wire the track and make the trains run and whatever is necessary. And we have that right now. And we got two or three people that are involved with our model railroad. At the present time, we're developing a new track system. It's the Lionel type of engine, not most of the stuff that you see in a lot of museums and a lot of is HO, which is very small and so forth. But the Lionel is the old trains from the 1940s and 50s and so forth. And we're developing a new area that the kids will be able to enjoy and so forth with the models. Yeah, the volunteers that have the skills and so forth is important. If we didn't have those individuals, it would be difficult to maintain, or we'd have to hire somebody. And there, in that field, there is no one that hires. There's, we have a couple different hobby modelers. There's one that's in Wilton, and then there's one over in Bismarck at Bucks Junction. And at times we can lean on them to help us out. So,
Bill, as I think about railroads in the United States, it sure seems to me that it's less emphasized than perhaps for transportation of people anyway than in Europe. Have you thought about that and why that evolved this way? You know, you talk about all of the small depots that were reachable here in North Dakota 100 years ago that just don't exist anymore. Why is railroad less important as a means of transportation here perhaps than it is elsewhere?
One thing, the interstate cars. Once the interstate was developed across the nation and so forth, people were able to drive cars wherever they wanted to go. The railroad type of system works in the big cities where people don't have place to park their cars. So, you know, people can go downtown on the train or the trolley or whatever and come back and so forth. But here in North Dakota, it's wide open and so forth. I think the depots in North Dakota, why we had so many at the beginning, was the railroad came in and helped develop these little communities and so forth that was surrounded by all the agriculture development and so forth.
Bill, as we wind up our conversation, and we're talking today about the North Dakota State Railroad Museum in Mandan, what do you think people are most surprised about when they come to the museum? And they leave thinking, geez, I didn't know that. What do you hear?
We got a little bit of everything. You know, there's a lot of railroad museums that you go there and they got a small old depot that they've kind of put some pictures in and so forth. And they might have a caboose sitting by the side. But we got 12 pieces of rolling stock. We got several areas of displays of different things and so forth. We have so much more. Years ago, we were up there one day working, and we got a call. It was before we were open, but a call, and somebody says, is somebody there? Can we stop by and look at it? And we said, fine, and they came and kind of went around the museum all over and spent probably 45 minutes or an hour there. And the gentleman came back and introduced himself, and he was from the California State Railroad Museum in Sacramento, and he was surprisingly impressed with what we had, because we had more than just a depot and a caboose. An important part of to our local community is it's a family attraction, and for people traveling, we get two types of people: families traveling and stopping and noting that it's free admission and so forth. Plus, we have railroad buffs that come from all over the United States that enjoy our museum because of what we have here.
Bill, we appreciate your time today. We've been visiting with Bill Engelter, and he is from the North Dakota State Railroad Museum. It's located in Mandan, and it's dedicated to preserving and showcasing the state's rich railroad history. Established in 1972 and designated as the official state railroad museum in 1989, it spans 5 acres and features a 3,000 square foot indoor space. Just a reminder, it's open every day from 1 to 4 throughout summer, and it's free with donations requested. Bill, thank you again for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you for inviting me to visit with you.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by A Taste of Ireland, a live music and dance production featuring international Irish dance champions, coming to Grand Forks June 8th. Information at atasteofirelandshow.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. So hazy skies, poor visibility, then thick smoke. Sounds like a summer in Southern California, right? But again, after a few days of breathing wildfire smoke, North Dakotans and Minnesotans are wondering. Here's the latest edition of our news podcast, Prairie Beat.
Hey, how's it going? I'm Eric Etheridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. Thank you for joining us for another edition of Prairie Beat.
This is where we take a closer and more in-depth look at stories from the Prairie Public Newsroom. So Danielle, what's on the beat this week?
Well, you know, I woke up today and I was just grateful to be able to take a big gulp of fresh air.
Yes, runner, I know where you're going with this. Ah, yes, that hazy smoke was pretty horrendous for a few days there.
Yes, it actually broke records, too. This is all due to wildfires in Canada.
I feel like for a few years now, we've been hearing the wildfires in Canada. What actually is going on up there?
Well, many regions of the country have a fire season, so you probably have heard that before, like in the western United States. And that's true for Canada, too. Canada has a lot of trees, but when I was looking a little deeper into this issue, I do admit it was a little shocking to see exactly how heavily forested these provinces can be.
Yes, that's what it is. It's not just tundra and ice up there. These are actual forest fires.
Pretty much. A lot of these fires have been taking place in Ontario, Saskatchewan, and Manitoba, but since I know many North Dakotans are familiar with Manitoba, I focused on that province. And it's a huge province. It covers over 250,000 square miles.
Virtually half of Manitoba is heavily forested. I remember as a kid those commercials, you remember them too, right? Smokey the Bear always saying, "Only you can prevent forest fires." So what's going on in Manitoba that's lighting these fires?
Well, I spoke with Ryan Mills about air quality concerns. He's the ambient air monitoring manager for North Dakota's Department of Environmental Quality. He was careful to tell me that he's not an expert on fires per se. He just monitors air quality. But he did say that over the past 10 years or so, fire activity has been increasing and really accelerating over the last 3 years in particular. And, you know, call it whatever you want, climate change or a dry cycle. The fact is the snowpack during the winters has been lacking and rains haven't been adequate. So it's much drier than normal. And really, think about it. What's the most important thing you need when you're having a backyard campfire?
You mean other than some marshmallows, graham crackers, and Hershey bars?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I obviously need some dry wood. Otherwise, that campfire is not going to get lit, not going to get ignited in the first place. That's why around here we keep our wood piles covered and dry.
Exactly. So just picture it. A vast forested expanse of land full of that perfect dry firewood.
Yeah, and also temperatures are rising globally, so I think we could say the temperatures are definitely going up. That has to play some kind of part in this. So I'm connecting the dots here. Come to think of it, that smoke did smell kind of a lot like the campfires, minus the hot dogs. I remember that when we were talking a few weeks ago about the wildfires in North Dakota, there were lots of things that were tied to those fires. The dry and windy conditions, fires starting any number of ways, sparks from a lawnmower, maybe a careless campfire here and there, even a lightning strike in rural areas especially can really ignite a fire.
Yes. And since these areas are not heavily populated, they don't have the people around to get these things under control. It makes getting them under control very difficult. Here's Ryan Mills on that.
I would say there it's very remote, number one. There's not a lot of road access. It's hard to get crews in and out of there. So I think they do a lot of it with either back burning or planes trying to put the fires out.
Back burning. Yeah, that's basically like controlled burns, right?
Correct. With the idea being, you know, if this such and such area has already burned, a fire couldn't cross it.
Man, with an area that big, where do you even start? How many DC-10s would it take to put out a fire when there's no fire stations around, really? Okay, so the fires start, they grow, and all that smoke makes its way down to North Dakota.
Exactly. And it kind of depends on what catches a ride on the jet stream, what makes it down here. If you'll remember, too, when the smoky haze first got here late last week, it was high up in the atmosphere, so you could see it, but it wasn't bothersome. And then a low-pressure weather system pushed all that smoke down to the ground level by midday Saturday. That's what Ryan Mills watches, the particulate matter, or PM, in the air from those fires.
And boy, oh boy, it was bad Saturday, and especially Sunday. It just seemed almost worse here in the Red River Valley. You know, I probably would have done myself a favor if I procrastinated the yard work I did last weekend for another day. I was trying to put a pool up, and man, it felt like I smoked an entire pack of cigarettes the way my lungs were working that day. Had to really knock it off early. So how do we know when it is safe to go outside or not?
You can check the airnow.gov website or download the app and plug in your location. Sensors are located all over the state, and they measure that particulate matter in the air. It updates every hour, and it has these ratings with a legend explaining them. Green is good, yellow is moderate, but still okay. But once you get past those levels, you need to pay closer attention. Orange is where it becomes unhealthy for sensitive groups, and then once you get above that into the red, purple, and maroon levels, it's just not healthy for anyone to be outside, period.
Yeah, you need a legend explaining it. So I guess I'll be explaining those color codes, right, Danielle? Now, you said earlier that the levels over this past weekend were record setting. So that doesn't sound like the kind of record we want.
No. Portions of North Dakota were reading in the red and purple indexes for much of the weekend and into the start of this week, too. Ryan Mills said that on Saturday, portions of northwestern and central North Dakota stayed in the purple range for over 24 hours, and that's actually the worst in state history. And we had some purple ratings here in the Red River Valley, too, so very unhealthy. When I interviewed him, I asked if this was something we'll just have to get used to.
I've never seen air like that, and it's kind of a sad statement that you can actually see the air. Because here in North Dakota, we're not accustomed to that. I mean, on an average day, we've got some of the cleanest air in the nation. So when we have this, has it become the norm? I guess it would have to say, yeah, it probably has become the norm. What's the end in sight? I guess the crystal ball would be great to have.
Yeah, it's becoming kind of the new normal, late spring, early summer here in North Dakota. When I first got here 10 years ago, I mean, the air was crisp and clean, the skies were blue, and every year gradually it just seems to be, you know, smokier and smokier and hazier, and I guess we're just going to have to get used to that. Now the air is out, the cold front pushed the smoky air out for now. Nice to see that blue sky again. Don't take it for granted now. So an event, it should return. It seems inevitable that it will. You said airnow.gov is what measures air quality.
Yes, you can visit that website or, again, download the app. The app is very handy. But I've found that some of my favorite weather radar apps also pull data from those AQI sensors. You can toggle those options, and it'll show you where the poor air quality is and where it's headed. The fact is, it's just not healthy. NPR recently reported that analysis published in the journal Epidemiology found that wildfire smoke can have long-ranging effects. It says the risk of hypertension or heart attack rose for months after exposure to smoke.
So thanks for that good info, Danielle. As we get deeper into the summer months here in North Dakota, now I understand we have one more thing to discuss. To round out the show, we are going to start sharing tidbits of other stories that we're watching. Tell us about three leads, oh journalist, please do. Three brief news stories to catch us up on.
Yes, so here are three headlines we are watching in the Prairie Public Newsroom. Number one. Calling it a soft report, Creighton University economist Dr. Ernie Goss says the May economic numbers are good despite uncertainty. This was a story from Todd McDonald about a monthly manufacturing survey we have followed for years. Number two, the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe is asking the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals to review a federal judge's decision to dismiss its latest lawsuit against the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers over the Dakota Access Pipeline. This saga is years in the making, and we will be hearing more about it this week. Number three, with 34 confirmed cases, North Dakota has the highest rate of measles in the country. This has been unfolding over the past few weeks. Remember, a lot fewer people live in North Dakota than many other places. Texas has about 2.4 cases per 100,000 people. In North Dakota, there are 4.2 cases per 100,000 people.
Wow, that's significant.
Indeed. Make sure to listen to Prairie Public for details on these and more stories from the Prairie Public Newsroom. You can also visit our news page at news.prairiepublic.org.
Thanks for all that, Danielle, our journalist extraordinaire. You can catch her weekdays 4 to 5:35 p.m. on All Things Considered here on Prairie Public. Thank you for listening, and that will do it for another edition of Prairie Beat. I'm Eric Etheridge.
And I'm Danielle Webster. We'll see you on the beat next week.
That was another edition of our news podcast, Prairie Beat. You can subscribe wherever you get your favorite podcasts, and new episodes drop every Wednesday. Prairie Beat is a great way to keep up with regional news when you don't have a lot of time.
This is Bird Note. Author Ray Youngbear has a special bond with a red-winged blackbird in his backyard on the Meskwaki Nation's land in Iowa.
The red-winged blackbird is very friendly, and it's the first time that's ever happened in my life. I've asked it in Meskwaki, Gewishaban, Nawadshabuichigan, I've got some food here, please wait. And the bird will listen, and then, you know, I'll just get the bird feed, and he takes it, and off it goes. And that's the first time in my life in 71 years that a bird has approached me that close.
But it's not the first time he's had interactions with these birds. Many years ago, when he was training his singing voice, Ray Youngbear took a kind of vocal lesson from the blackbirds.
In order to hone my skills with music, I'm a singer of native songs, and I'd go out into the field way out of nowhere and scream my lungs out, my throat out, and oftentimes the birds that I would hear in the woods were the red wings, and I would listen to them and try to imitate their singing. They have the most complicated song in the world. High pitches and low notes, and then it smooths out and it kicks up again. And I used red-winged blackbirds in my self-training of music, and they were instrumental in developing my voice to where it is today.
Learn more about Ray Youngbear's music and writing on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Ariana Rummel.
Still to come on Main Street, Prairie Plates with Rick Yon. Rick hosts Sarah Watson in the Main Street studio and also shares his recent interview with Molly Yeh from her recent Fargo book event. That's all ahead. Stay with us.
I like bagels.
All I eat is pizza.
Eat some barbecue.
Applesauce and some nice red beets.
There's the walk-up music we have on Wednesdays. It's time for Prairie Plates, and we're diving into the heart of Upper Midwest cooking. Rick Yon joins me in the Main Street studio, as he does every week, except maybe the last 2 weeks. Rick, I took a week off a couple weeks ago, and you did last week. We're back together again. Hope things are going well.
Things are going well. I've missed doing this segment, but we're back now, and we have some really good guests this week.
Oh, we do. Sarah Watson, she's a chef, storyteller, and author of the now sold-out cookbook Cabin Chef. Her recipes are as much about memory and place as they are about flavor. She draws on her deep roots in eastern North Dakota and Minnesota Lakes Country. And she's back from the Molly Yeh book event at the Jasper Hotel, Rick, that you also were at. Let's learn more about that first, Sarah, and then we'll get into your history. But Sarah, welcome to Prairie Plates.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate the invite.
All right, Rick, tell me more about the event with Molly Yeh at the Jasper Hotel.
Well, yeah, Rosewild is the restaurant in the Jasper Hotel, and last Wednesday, a week ago now, it's hard to believe, actually, it was so much fun. I actually sat with Sarah and her family at the event. But yeah, Molly had two dinner seatings and book signings. And what she wrote in my book was, "Yo, Rick, hot dish forever." Because we were hot dish contest judges at Brewhalla. That's right. Yes, a couple years ago. And so she's become kind of a buddy of mine, and she's just a really wonderful person and is doing so much for the food scene, not only in this area, because she lives right outside of East Grand Forks on a sugar beet farm. And so her new book is called Sweet Farm. And I got to interview her for a few minutes. She was very busy with that event. The two seatings sold out, and the book signings were quite popular. But I did get a few minutes with her, and maybe we should just listen to that quick. I'm here with Food Network star and cookbook author Molly Yeh. She's visiting Fargo today. And Molly, what are you up to here tonight?
What up, Rick? I am here for an event with Rose Wild. I am so excited. We have a beautiful menu planned, and I love it here. I love the way that Rose Wild celebrates local cuisine in a really beautiful, elevated way. And this event is going to partially be in celebration of my latest cookbook, Sweet Farm, which came out a few months ago. And I'm just excited to hang out with the crowd and sign some books and eat some good food.
Tell us a little bit about the book.
The book is all about sweets, my favorite food group, and it has so many cookies and cakes and bars, and there's a whole chapter on sweet salads. And it was a book that I felt I've always knew that I had to write a book about sweets because I love sweets so much, and also I married a sugar farmer. So it was inevitable, and I'm just so happy that it's out in the world.
Any favorite recipes that you really like to focus on?
So one of my favorites is actually going to be on the menu at Rose Wild for a limited time. It is the saffron cardamom tiramisu.
Oh, my.
And it's so good.
Yes.
There's Earl Grey in it. There's some pistachio. There's rose. There's a lot. If you look at the ingredients list, to me, it just reads like poetry because it has so many of my favorite ingredients in one dish. And there's a lot going on, but it all comes together really beautifully. It's light, it's floral, it's perfect for this gorgeous weather that we're having. And also somebody asked me the other day, could a tiramisu be a cookie salad? And like, I think that that argument could be made. So that'll be on the menu at Rose Wild. And then I also just love like a big chewy frosted cookie.
Yes.
Chewy tahini cookies in the book. I love, there's like chewy frosting-filled pistachio sandwich cookie that I love too. So, all the good hearty stuff.
Now, you said you live on a sweet farm. So what's that all about?
My husband farms sugar beets. So I get to see my primary ingredient grown before my very eyes. And then I put into use. And it truly is a full circle situation because growing up, I didn't know what a sugar beet was. And then when I first started dating my husband, that was one of our first conversations was, what is that root vegetable tattooed on your arm? Like, it's a sugar beet. I was like, what is a sugar beet? I've never heard of
that. That's dedication.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's right there. You can't even, like, cover it up with a T-shirt. Like, if he's wearing a T-shirt, it just pokes right out. But, so his family, he's fifth generation on his farm. Second or third generation as a sugar beet farmer, well. So we live and breathe sugar on our farm.
And you live up by East Grand Forks,
yep,
right?
Yeah, right outside of East Grand.
So this is Red River Valley sugar.
Oh, yeah, the good stuff.
Molly, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Rick. Good to see you.
And of course, Rick, also Molly has Bernie's in East Grand Forks, too. If you haven't been there, it's a great place to have a bite to eat for sure.
It is. And she has very good baked goods. I think she's just a real pro in that area. Wouldn't you say, Sarah?
Yes, I hear. I've been there and I love it. Her bakery counter is very popular.
I'll say this too. My grandkids love watching Molly on television. She's so down to earth. She's such obviously a great baker, a great chef. And she's just so pleasant and really kind of obviously family oriented in what she tries to do here in Eastern North Dakota and Western Minnesota.
Yeah, I'd say she's very personable. And at the first seating with the actual book signing, the sit-down book signing, because the second seating, she just went around and talked to folks and signed their books, which was a lot of fun too. But at the first seating, the line was out the door, and boy, people were excited to talk to her. And she's just really good with folks. And maybe one day we'll get her in the studio here at Prairie
Public.
Let's
do that, Rick. Yes. Yeah, let's do that. But Sarah, I want to turn to you. Cabin Chef is currently sold out. Wow. And congratulations. What inspired you to write it in the first place? And why do you think it's resonated so well with readers?
Well, thank you for that. You know, I always wanted to write a cookbook, and I have like a million ideas and a couple journals that I like started, you know, brainstorming what this book would be about. It wasn't Cabin Chef. It was actually a friend who frequented one of the restaurants I had out in Lakes Country, Blackboard. And he was a publisher in the media, and he had the Cabin Chef idea was kind of his dream, and he was looking for the right person to collaborate with. So that was me. And he brought it up to me in the heat of the moment during service one day. He stopped in the kitchen and I quickly said yes, because I've always wanted to. And at that moment, I think I thought it would be easy to write a cookbook.
What was the hardest part about it? I'm curious about that.
Yeah. You know, when you write a cookbook, it's very different than how I cook. So I'm not a baker. I'm not like Molly in that way, because that involves measuring and weighing and more science. I rely a lot on my palate, and what tastes good to me is what I think other people will like. And so it's a little bit of this, a little bit of that. All of a sudden, while I was working on the recipes for the cookbook, I was using my methods of just quickly adding something instead of measuring it. And I was like, oh no, I have to start over, because if somebody's going to make this, it needs to be right.
That's how I cook too.
Well, so, you know, the recipe development was more challenging for me than I anticipated. Also, we were working on this through the summer in Lakes Country, and you can imagine how busy a restaurant out there is at that time. The goal was to have this out printed and out by October so people could purchase it for Christmas gifts. I'm thankful for the publisher. At the moment, I don't think I was. At midnight, he was barking at me to get 20 more recipes done. Thank goodness he was, because we did it. But I was like, oh my gosh, what did I sign up for? Yes, it is. My name is on the book, but it was a team of people who put this beautiful book together. So Scott Thuin was the photographer. And if you look at the book, the pictures are phenomenal. The designers who designed it, oh my gosh, like it all just came together.
And for those not familiar, when Sarah references Blackboard, that's a restaurant north of the Silent Lakes in Otter Tail County on Highway 41. It's in an old schoolhouse. For a lot of people, it's the old pickle factory, but it's a wonderful restaurant in the middle of Lakes Country, kind of by Virgis, Minnesota. They have screened-in patios, so those skeeters won't bug you, but it's casual fine dining. You can get in off the water. You know, you're going to have to drive a little bit, but you don't need to dress up. It's just a really fun place, and the cocktails are really good too. So it's just one of those places in Minnesota Lakes Country to check out. But Sarah's also, you know, back in the day here in Fargo, in downtown Fargo, helped open Mezzaluna, helped open Rustica and Moorhead. Are any of those recipes in the book from those establishments?
Yes. In fact, the maple chicken salad follows me around and everybody likes it. And when I'm not currently involved in a restaurant, it kind of disappears and I get emails and phone calls to see if people can buy it from me bulk. So I don't think that either one is currently on Mezzaluna or Rustica's menu, but that we also had Mosaic Catering, and so that was one of the big sellers for catering. The burrata marinated tomatoes that you're seeing everywhere right now, that was something we brought really early on. I believe Mezzaluna first, and then Rustica also. But now it's up Blackboard. It's It's at the new place, Smoke and Iron, out in West Fargo, and other restaurants too. It, you know, sometimes I don't want to say cooks copy each other, but we do. So when I'm out at another restaurant in Minneapolis or somewhere, and I'm like, "This is good," you know, how can I recreate this and bring this to Fargo Moorhead or to our area? And I think that's what we all do, you know, in the business.
Yeah, you kind of riff on each other and take what you like and then maybe make some improvements and some of your own twists. I mean, that's pretty typical of how the culinary circles work.
Absolutely. You know, it just is. So,
Sarah, your daughter Kina is now in on this food and hospitality work, and it's kind of crossing now generations in your family life.
It is. You know, I have four kids, and all of them have helped in different ways in the restaurants. And I never saw, or I never thought that any one of them would, you know, have an interest in pursuing, just knowing how restaurants are hard. You know, we work nights and weekends when everybody else is enjoying, things like that. Kina is going into hospitality, and she's making her own name out there, not so much in the restaurant, but on the hotel side. You know, so maybe look for her in 5 or 10 years running some cute boutique hotels. She knows the restaurant business very well, so she gets pulled over to help. Maybe it's training or just jumping in and helping with whatever is needed. So at 19 years old, she's already making her name and being a very valuable employee to everybody she helps.
And maybe someday, if she gets into culinary, she'll write a cookbook.
Aye, she might.
So now that you've had success with Cabin Chef, are you thinking about round two with the book?
Yes. In fact, there are some coals in the fire. It'll be very different than Cabin Chef, another collaboration of sorts, so stay tuned for that.
It's a tease there, Rick.
Yeah. Well, Sarah's involved in this new restaurant in West Fargo called Smoke and Iron, and I was over there a few weeks ago to try a few things out. I really had a great hanger steak with some chimichurri and some other appetizers that were really good. Sarah, can you talk a little bit about some of the dishes over there?
It's been a really fun project over there. We have some very talented cooks and chefs involved. So I was really honored when I was asked to come in and help write the menu that our community would embrace, I suppose. But I'm lucky enough to be working with a very talented chef from Oaxaca, Mexico, named Octavio Ramirez, and listen for his name because it's going to come up. But that chimichurri you're talking about, Rick, on the hanger steak is Octavio's recipe, and you know, it makes the plate. So
it does.
A hanger steak is a hanger steak, but when you put a good sauce with it, oh my gosh, it's our best seller over there right now. So
that doesn't surprise me.
Yeah. you'll see his influence on a lot of dishes. We, you know, things that are more Midwestern, we put a Oaxacan mole sauce on. There's some plantains involved. There's a beautiful mango chili mango barbecue sauce on our chicken. So when I was working with him on the menu, I was like, okay, well, people like barbecue chicken, you know, let's make our own barbecue sauce. And all of a sudden he's like, well, try this. He already had one made. And I was like, well, that's it. So it's a fun collaboration. Ramon Sosa's, the brains behind it and pulled us all together. Stay tuned for that as it grows and, you know, the menu is going to grow. Right now we're in early stages with it, so everybody's learning the basics, and it's going to be a nice little spot for our community.
And for those who know Ramon, know he's involved with Maxwell's in West Fargo as well, and that's just really a great restaurant. It's a kind of a statewide destination for a lot of people coming in from Bismarck and Grand Forks.
Absolutely. And fun fact, I was involved in Maxwell's back in the day. So, did you know that, Rick?
I did not.
So the reason Ramon is there was because I was there. I was part of the first group as it changed from Little Fields to Maxwell's, developing the menu. Chef Mike Wald is still there. He was part of that opening then too. Ramon and my sister, he's married to my sister, moved back here from Mexico around that time, and Ramon came on board with us. As we moved on to Mezzaluna, he stayed with Maxwell's and has made it, and Mike Wald, Chef Mike Wald is there too, and they've just made it an iconic North Dakota restaurant.
And people can find your cuisine, too, around the holiday season, maybe at an art museum around here.
Oh, yes. The Plains Art Museum is dear to me. So the holiday noon concerts, I am honored to get to do the lunches there. It's very festive. It's become a tradition for me. I hope they ask me again next year because I'll be disappointed if they don't.
There's always a cadre of folks from Prairie Public that enjoy those holiday noon concerts, and we're very thankful for the very delicious lunch, too. And I tend to overspend when I'm over there. I'm like, wow, I got this, I got that. Okay, well, it'll be a good day. That's all right.
Then that means I wrote the menu right. You know what
yes.
I mean? I want, in any establishment I've been involved with, the idea is for people to look at the menu and be like, I don't know what to get. So you're either going to do what Rick does and have a few choices, or hopefully you're going to come back tomorrow.
Try the rest of the menu. What's the biggest bomb you've put on a menu, Sarah?
That's
anything
hilarious.
That sticks in your mind?
Oh,
yeah.
My gosh. That sticks in my mind because it always happens. I try not to remember them, I guess. I know one that I was so excited for. I've traveled a little bit, and one thing I love is, especially if you're near the sea, is whole fish. You know, fried whole fish, head on. You know, let's just dive into this thing and eat it. So I brought in some beautiful whole bronzino from the Mediterranean, and we were going to do that at Blackboard. And I thought for sure it was going to be a hit because here we are at the lakes. You know, it's just kind of one of those things. Oh, my God, I had so much fish sent back because the head was on. And I was like, just try it. And they're like, I can't eat this fish when it's looking at me. So I was like, okay, we're not ready for that here. We are landlocked.
So. I would not have ordered that in all honesty. Rick, would you have tried it?
Oh, I love fish with the head on and the bones in. There's something about the flavor, the moisture. It's just a very delicious thing. But yeah, I mean, in Lakes Country, Minnesota, people are used to their filleted walleye and their filleted crappie, so I can see.
It was a little too much.
I think my favorite thing at Blackboard, and I don't know if you were still there, there was this barbecue rib plate for a while. Oh my gosh, it was like a big board, not a blackboard, but a walnut board, and boy, was that good.
I know exactly what you're talking about. Absolutely delicious. We were just getting going with smoking things at that time. And I want to say we had a chef, Tamara Tanksley, who was really into the ribs, and she did a great job with them. So, and I think they still do.
Well, when I pulled up, I noticed a smoker out back, and it was smoking, and it smelled real good. And so then I inquired inside, and then they're like, well, we have a rib special. Well, I'm going to order that for sure. So.
That's fantastic. I love to hear that.
All right, Rick, let's wrap it up. Our very special guest has been Chef Sarah Watson. She's a chef, a storyteller, and author of the now sold-out cookbook, Cabin Chef. Sarah, it has been great having you with us here on Prairie Plates.
Well, thank you for the invite. It's been great to be here.
And Rick, we're going to talk cocktails next week here on Prairie Plates.
Yeah, I think we'll have somebody in from the drawing room / Mezzaluna if I can track them down. But yeah, summer cocktails, I think it'll be a good conversation.
Thanks to both of you for Prairie Plates today.
Thank you.
We'll talk soon, Craig.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Starian Bank, determined to provide smart banking solutions with innovative checking accounts and personal banking tools that match your lifestyle. Starian, taking you farther. Learn more at StarianBank.com.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 4th. At one time, catching frogs in North Dakota was big business. In 1923, it was reported that a Lisbon man was making good money catching frogs and shipping them to eastern markets. He found the business quite lucrative. He said they shipped 40 pounds of frog legs every day. Packed in ice, they arrived at their destinations in good condition.
September, he said, was the best month to catch frogs. There was high demand for frog legs in upscale restaurants. A 1910 newspaper article reported that 12.5 tons of frog legs were consumed in Detroit restaurants the previous year. It was such a big business that during the 1920s, an illegal frog bootlegging syndicate was operating in Minnesota. At the time, Minnesota law prohibited shipping frogs out of the state. The state Fish and Game Commissioner said frogs were being illegally sent to eastern markets. The North Dakota Game Commissioner estimated that the state's frog business had earned between $50,000 and $75,000 in the previous year. On this date in 1925, frogs could breathe a little easier as new frog logs were announced. With the season opening on June 1st, there were plenty of questions from frog hunters trying to understand the new rules. The period from April 1st to May 31st was now closed to hunting. Frogs had to measure at least 2.5 inches from nose to the base of the spinal column. Anything smaller was off limits, and frog hunters had to buy a frog hunting license for 50 cents. Frog legs are no longer common fare in American restaurants, though they remain traditional in the South. Occasionally, they appear on menus as a delicacy. Today, about 5 million frogs are imported to the U.S. from Asia each year, a number far short of the 12.5 tons consumed in Detroit in 1910. Frog hunting still takes place in North Dakota, though not at the scale seen in the early 1900s. Any resident or a member of the resident's family can hunt frogs on their own property during open season. Anyone with a fishing license can also hunt frogs and may take up to 24 frogs. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Hi, I'm Mary Louise Kelly. We are at an inflection point when it comes to journalism, a fork in the road, if you will. We could head down the path to where only a few agenda-driven companies control the flow of information. Or we could energize the reliable sources for fact-driven, unbiased, uninfluenced news. One of those dependable sources is public radio. While trusted publications often require a paid subscription, public radio's over-the-air and digitally on-demand service is free for everyone. We rely on voluntary donations from our listeners to share in the costs. In North Dakota, public radio means Prairie Public. So please support the excellent regional coverage and the global and national reporting here at NPR. Just go to prairiepublic.org and open the donate tab.
And that wraps up this Wednesday edition of Main Street. We are grateful that you've spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, we'll preview Art Fest. It's coming up this weekend in Grand Forks, plus Matt Olean reviews Tom Cruise's newest Mission Impossible movie. We look forward to seeing you again tomorrow, right here on Main Street.